Welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We've got some celebrity news, royal news, and of course plenty of politics, especially in election season. We're going to start off with a memorial. One Direction, Harry Styles, Louis Tomlinson, and Zayn Malik share Liam Payne tributes. This is by Chris Murphy, published on October 17th. The former members of One Direction have broken their silence following fellow member Liam Payne's death. Here's the update. On Friday, Harry Styles mourned the loss of his former bandmate in a lovely post on Instagram. "I am truly devastated by Liam's passing," Styles wrote. "His greatest joy was making other people happy, and it was an honor to be alongside him as he did it. Liam lived wide open, with his heart on his sleeve. He had an energy for life that it was infectious. He was warm, supportive, and incredibly loving. The years we spent together will forever remain among the most cherished years of my life. I will miss him always, my lovely friend. My heart breaks for Karen, Jeff, Nicola, and Ruth, his son Bear, and all those around the world who knew and loved him as I did." The original story said, the previous day, Thursday, One Direction's official Instagram account released a statement on behalf of Styles, Niall Horan, Louis Tomlinson, and Zayn Malik, addressing the tragic death of Payne, who died on Wednesday at age 31. In 2010, One Direction was formed after each member originally competed individually on the UK singing competition program, The X Factor, with Payne, Styles, Horan, Malik, and Tomlinson going on to be handpicked to form a boy band. One Direction ended up being a pop music phenomenon, earning recognition as one of the best-selling boy bands of all time, releasing 5 studio albums and spawning hits like What Makes You Beautiful, Story of My Life, and Little Things. The group went on indefinite hiatus in 2016. The statement continued, "The memories we shared with him will be treasured forever. For now, our thoughts are with his family, his friends, and the fans who loved him alongside us. We will miss him terribly. We love you, Liam." Tomlinson was the first former One Directioner to release a solo tribute to Payne. "I am beyond devastated to be writing this, but yesterday I lost a brother," he wrote on Instagram, captioning a photo of himself performing alongside Payne. "Liam was somebody I looked up to every day, such a positive, funny, and kind soul." In the tribute, Tomlinson called Payne the most vital part of One Direction and said that they often spoke of getting back in the studio together to try and recreate the writing chemistry we had built up in the band. He ended his tribute with a direct address to Payne and a reference to Bear, Payne's 7-year-old son with ex-girlfriend Cheryl. "I want you to know that if Bear ever needs me, I will be the uncle he needs in his life and tell him stories of how amazing his dad was. I wish I got the chance to say goodbye and tell you one more time how much I loved you," Tomlinson wrote. "Payno, my boy, one of my best friends, my brother, I love you, mate. Sleep well, X." About an hour later, Malik released his own tribute to Payne on Instagram, which began with a photo of himself and Payne leaning on each other while sleeping. In the next slide, Malik shared his feelings about Payne's untimely passing. "Liam, I have found myself talking out loud to you, hoping you can hear me. I can't help but think selfishly that there was so many more conversations for us to have in our lives," he began. "I never got to thank you for supporting me through some of the most difficult times in my life." Malik continued, noting that Payne's sensible, headstrong, and opinionated personality caused the two to butt heads at times. "I always secretly respected you for it," he wrote after a crying, laughing emoji. "When it came to music," Malik said, "Payne was the most qualified in every sense. I knew nothing in comparison. I was a novice child with no experience, and you were already a professional," he wrote. "I lost a brother when you left us and can't explain to you what I'd give to just give you a hug one last time and say goodbye to you properly and tell you that I loved and respected you dearly," Malik said. He ended his emotional message with a note to Payne and a simple sign-off. "I hope that wherever you are right now, you are good and are at peace, and you know how loved you are. Love you, bro." Next in celebrity news, Taylor Swift takes Travis Kelce out to the ball game before Eras Tour resumes. This is by Casey Wickman, published on October 15th. Taylor Swift and boyfriend Travis Kelce welcomed the dads, Brads, and Chads of Major League Baseball to the fold Monday night when they headed to the Bronx for the first game of the American League Championship Series to watch the Yankees face off against the Cleveland Guardians. Some social media users grumbled, with one writing, "TBS, stop showing Taylor Swift. We don't give a damn." About broadcasters cutting to the couple during the game, a replay of the same tired whining from a certain pocket of the NFL since Swift attended her first Kansas City game last September. It would appear that the two are getting their hangs in, Jumbotron or no, before Swift returns to Miami this weekend to kick off the final leg of the Eras Tour with a three-show run in the city. Kelce is currently midway through a bye week with his Kansas City Chiefs, a bit of cosmic schedule alignment that allowed the couple a final few date nights before Swift gets back to doing it with a broken heart on stage throughout North America until the tour wraps in December. Kelce grew up in Westlake, Ohio, just outside Cleveland proper, and even threw out a ceremonial first pitch at a Cleveland game in 2023. So let's assume that the couple, clad in black baseball caps and dark outfits, keeping a relatively low profile in a suite with comedian Jared Carmichael, were not rooting for the home team. The Yankees triumphed over the Guardians with a 5-2 win, but on the plus side, someone did post a video of Swift hand-feeding Kelce popcorn on social media. Win some, lose some. More sadness in the Swiftiverse. Acknowledging that the Eras Tour is almost over, Swift's Miami shows marking the beginning of the end of a worldwide odyssey enjoyed by fans in person, in theaters, and at home via her record-breaking concert film and over unofficial TikTok live streams aplenty over the past year and a half. To soothe the pain of the tour's inevitable end, on Tuesday morning, Swift announced via social media that on November 29th, at long last, the extended anthology double album edition of The Tortured Poets Department will be available on vinyl and CD, the first time the full 35-track behemoth has been set to a physical format, and that she's releasing a big old coffee table book, Taylor Swift, The Eras Tour Book, on the same day. All will first be available in Target stores on Black Friday, November 29th, and then will be on the Target app and online on November 30th. The supersized version of the album was previously only available in digital format. Both four-disc vinyl pressing and the CD will include all 35 tracks, including four acoustic recordings. The 256-page book includes more than 500 photos of the tour, rehearsal process, and behind the scenes, plus costume sketches and concepts, notes, and reflections from Swift. Here is the official retrospective of the most wondrous tour of my life, my beloved Eras Tour, Swift said of the book in a press release. Thank you to the fans who came to this show. You are what made the Eras Tour what it became. Ahead of her Miami dates, Swift donated $5 million to hurricane relief efforts in the area via Feeding America, the organization announced last week. A little more on Taylor. Taylor Swift returns to Eras Tour Road as Tom Brady, Serena Williams, and Hoda Kotb cheer her on. This is by Eve Beatty, published on October 19th. Back in the office, Taylor Swift wrote on Instagram Friday the caption to a video of a walk through Miami Gardens Hard Rock Stadium. The casually dressed singer, who was carrying her cat, Olivia Benson, was indeed back at work last night, kicking off the final leg of her years-long Eras Tour in front of tens of thousands of famous and anonymous fans, as well as slews of billboards urging concertgoers to support Vice President Kamala Harris's campaign for president. Watching Swift's video, one can't help but wonder why her cat is so much calmer and better behaved than the average cat, which would have squirmed, scratched, and, if it were my cat, leapt out of her arms and into an impossible-to-reach stadium crevice while screaming and howling. Then again, this is the same cat that arguably outshined Taylor Swift when they shared the screen for Diet Coke, so comparing her to the average cat might be a false dichotomy. Swift has been busy since we last saw her on stage. She's caught a couple of Kansas City Chiefs home games, donated millions to Hurricane Helene and Milton's recovery efforts, and endorsed Harris for president. That decision triggered the Republican candidate, former President Donald Trump, to incorrectly predict that it would destroy Swift's popularity. That repetitional damage wasn't in evidence Friday night when she took the stage for the first of three sold-out shows in the redder-than-red state of Florida. Perhaps the crowd was bolstered by out-of-town celebrities who were also in attendance. TMZ spotted Tom Brady, Miley Cyrus, Serena Williams, Hoda Kotb, and Savannah Guthrie in the crowd. Also present was Jason Kelce, the brother of Swift's boyfriend Travis Kelce. The former Philadelphia Eagle either fell asleep or pretended to during the show, reports the Post. But by keeping his eyes closed, he missed some surprises. BuzzFeed notes that she debuted four new costumes for this final run of shows, while the Miami Herald reports that Florence Welch appeared on stage for Florida, her duet with Swift from the most recent album, The Tortured Poets Department. Swift's Eras Tour will continue through the end of 2024, with subsequent three-night stands in New Orleans and Indianapolis. Then it's off to Canada for the last leg of the tour, which will end on Sunday, December 8th in Vancouver. Let's check in with the Royals. King Charles and Queen Camilla kick off Australian Tour, their first as monarchs. This is by Katie Nicholl on October 18th. King Charles and Queen Camilla arrived in Sydney to an official welcome for the first leg of their Australia tour on Friday. Charles, who has suspended his cancer treatments while he carries out the tour, appeared in good spirits despite the long-haul flight and rain that greeted the couple upon landing. As they stepped down to the tarmac, Queen Camilla and King Charles sheltered under umbrellas as they are welcomed by Prime Minister of Australia, Anthony Albanese, and several key federal and state representatives, including Sam Mostyn, the Governor General of the Commonwealth of Australia. Queen Camilla was presented with a posy from a 12-year-old boy named Kai from near Adelaide in South Australia, whose wish to meet their majesties is being granted by the Make-A-Wish Foundation and his sister Charlotte. It's the first time King Charles and Queen Camilla have been in Australia since Charles became the country's head of state in September 2022. The trip is significant for many reasons. Though it is Charles' 17th visit to the nation, it is his first as king. He is the second British monarch to ever visit Australia. His mother, the late Queen Elizabeth, was the first in 1954. She last visited in October 2011 during the trip to the Royal Australian Air Force Base in Fairburn, Canberra. As King Charles visits Sydney and Canberra, his schedule will include supporting environmental projects, meeting political and community leaders, and a naval review in Sydney Harbour. Before arriving, the royal family posted archival footage of the royals' previous visits to Instagram, writing, "Ahead of our first visit to Australia as King and Queen, we are really looking forward to returning to this beautiful country to celebrate the extraordinarily rich cultures and communities that make it so special." Despite reports of an anti-monarchist sentiment sweeping the country and the excursion being called a farewell tour by some, local news outlets predicted record crowds turning out for the King and Queen. However, the visit will inevitably reopen the debate over whether Australia should be a republic with its own head of state, something King Charles has made clear should be the choice of the Australian public. Charles made his opinions known in letters exchanged between the palace and the Australian Republic movement ahead of the tour, and was reported by the Daily Mail. A referendum on the issue was held in Australia in 1999, where citizens voted to remain a constitutional monarchy. Earlier this year, Australia's government said plans for another referendum were not a priority. Buckingham Palace has said the trip will focus on meeting many Australians and themes designed to celebrate the best of Australia, as well as reflecting aspects of the King and Queen's work. King Charles has close connection with Australia, dating back to 1966 when, as the Prince of Wales, Charles spent two terms at Geelong Grammar School in Corio. In total, His Majesty has visited Australia 16 times, both whilst serving in the Royal Navy and on official visits, always demonstrating a deep interest in and passion for the work and people of Australia. Queen Camilla also has close ties to the country, which she has visited four times. She first visited in 2012 during the late Queen's Diamond Jubilee. Camilla has important connections with the country as Colonel-in-Chief of the Royal Australian Corps of the Military Police, patron of UK Harvest, which is associated with Oz Harvest, a food rescue organization, and patron of Give It. The other royals, Prince William is apparently an NFL fan and can throw an American football. This is by Aaron Vanderhoof, published on October 16th. On Tuesday, Prince William traveled to London's Kensington neighborhood to show off his skills at a distinctly American pastime. During an event with the NFL Foundation UK, he grabbed a football and took a lesson in throwing it like a quarterback. At a flag football day celebrating the third anniversary of the Football League's community outreach across the pond, one participant gave him a football with a Union Jack, and in response, he shared that he would use it to play with his children, Prince George, Princess Charlotte, and Prince Louis. "Never go home empty-handed. That's a crucial motto of being a parent," he said. "We'll do some practice together. Let's see how many windows I can smash." For the first decade of their marriage, Prince William and Kate Middleton reportedly had permission from Queen Elizabeth II to focus on bringing up their three children, so they have plenty of good parenting tips. Though their roles as working royals have sent them around the world and take up plenty of their time, they've arranged their schedules so that they are able to consistently take their children to school in the morning and even host a few of their children's friends for palace playdates. During the Tuesday event, William also spoke to Phoebe Schechter, Great Britain's women's flag football captain, and according to the AP, she gave him a pointer on throwing the ball. "Embrace your inner Shakira and shake your hips." Following their playtime, Louis Rhys Zammit gave him a teal Jacksonville Jaguars jersey with HRH emblazoned on the back. Rhys Zammit, a 23-year-old from Penarth, Wales, played professional rugby football in the UK before taking part in the NFL's International Players Pipeline program earlier this year. Following an initial signing to the roster of the Kansas City Chiefs, he joined the Jaguars practice squad as a running back in August. Rhys Zammit later told People that William was interested in hearing about his journey from the UK to America. "He was intrigued about the transition I'm doing and the sport itself," the athlete said. "He asked me what I could bring from rugby into the NFL, like my speed." And the other brother, Prince Harry, surfs with Kelly Slater at a man-made wave facility. This is by Aaron Vanderhoof on October 17th. Though Prince Harry and Meghan Markle live close to the beach in Montecito, California, this week the prince took a trip a few hours inland to show off his surfing talents at a man-made wave facility in Lemoore. Harry joined professional surfers Kelly Slater and Raymana Van Bastelaer at Slater's Surf Ranch, according to an Instagram video that Van Bastelaer shared to his Instagram account on October 16th. In the video, Harry is prone on his surfboard before he stands up in order to ride an oncoming wave, following shouted instructions. Once Harry was in position, Van Bastelaer shouted, "Love you, brother." During their 2018 trip to Australia and 2019 trip to South Africa, Meghan and Harry both met with nonprofits that included surfing in their charitable outreach. In 2020, Meghan reportedly gifted Harry surf lessons for his 36th birthday soon after the couple moved to their current home in Montecito. And a source told Page Six Harry was having the best time. Harry's enthusiasm for the water might explain another recent rumor about Meghan and Harry's search for a vacation home. According to the Daily Mail's Richard Eden, the couple has their eyes on a property in Portugal. A representative for the Duke and Duchess declined to comment. A property in Portugal would give the couple a foothold across the Atlantic, which would facilitate more visits to the UK, like the one Harry took late last month. It would also allow them to spend more time with Harry's cousin, Princess Eugenie, who started spending time in the country in 2022 when her husband, Jack Brooksbank, took a job at Costa Terra Golf and Ocean Club, a seaside resort in Miletus. In a 2023 podcast interview, Eugenie said she enjoys her time in the Iberian nation because she can live under the radar. "I can go to the supermarket in my exercise gear and my hair piled on my head and not mind, not care," she said. "No one cares." Last fall, Meghan and Harry traveled to Miletus following their time at the Invictus Games in Dusseldorf, Germany, reportedly staying at Jack and Eugenie's home in the exclusive development, which also offers surf lessons. Over the course of a three-day visit, the Duke and Duchess also ran into Chris Evans and Alba Baptista during their honeymoon, Page Six reported at the time. Local outlet Nova Genti added that the couple were spotted traveling with their two bodyguards during their stay in the country and that they were able to have a super-secret getaway. Moving to Hollywood, Meryl Streep and Martin Short do it again. Have dinner together, that is. This is by Casey Wickman, published on October 18th. Martin Short and Meryl Streep are at the center of more than one unsolved mystery. There's the one on season 4 of Only Murders in the Building, the Hulu show on which they co-star as love interests, but there's also the haze of ambiguity around Short and Streep's relationship in real life, fueled most recently by yet another night out. The two septuagenarians apparently enjoyed dinner together Wednesday night at Santa Monica, California celebrity favorite Italian restaurant, Giorgio Baldi. They were photographed arriving and leaving the restaurant together, Short clad in a gray suit with black sneakers, and Streep in a smart casual slacks and nice blouse ensemble with mule flats to finish off the look. Streep drove the pair in her car with Short smiling in the shotgun seat. The two celebrated actors have been the subject of speculation about whether they're more than friends and co-stars for nearly a year, the rumors picking up steam in January, when the two looked cozy while attending the Golden Globes. They've shared meals, taken in Broadway shows, and even held hands on the red carpet at the season premiere festivities for Only Murders, with their reps insisting all the while that they're just good friends and co-stars. Short himself even addressed the rumor while appearing on Bill Maher's podcast in late January, telling the host, "We're not a couple, we're just very close friends." Close friends who are having an absolute blast together, like when they were seen laughing and palling around in the front row at the Emmys in September. Both Streep and Short were previously part of long marriages. Short is a widower. He was married to Nancy Dolman from 1980 until she died of ovarian cancer in 2010. Streep married Don Gummer in 1978, and in October 2023, her representatives confirmed that while they will always care for each other, they have chosen lives apart. And the couple revealed that they had been separated for more than 6 years. Representatives for Meryl Streep and Martin Short did not immediately respond to Vanity Fair's request for comment. This being election season, we are turning to election news a little bit early, or politics a little bit early, I should say. Our first headline, Money Talks. Elon Musk, the Trump campaign surrogate. This is by Caitlin Dewey on October 16th. Elon Musk sunk almost $75 million into a pro-Trump super PAC last quarter, the latest sign that the controversial billionaire and tech CEO is going all in on dark MAGA. According to new campaign finance reports, Musk is the sole donor to American PAC, a political action committee he created earlier this year. The organization famously promised cash payouts to anyone who could get swing state voters to sign a statement saying they supported the First and Second Amendments and worked to increase voter registration and turnout in battleground states, including Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. It has also backed Republican candidates in a series of tight congressional races, several of them in California. On Tuesday night, Musk also announced plans to deliver a string of talks across Pennsylvania, open to those who sign America PAC's petition. It's the latest step in his evolution into a quasi-campaign surrogate after previously hosting a live interview with Donald Trump on X, amplifying the former president's lies about immigration and the federal hurricane response, and leaping around the stage at an October 6 Trump rally in Butler, Pennsylvania. Those antics could dent Musk's real business, which, whatever his political ambitions, still involves making and selling cars, satellites, rockets, and social media ad space. Last week, the California Coastal Commission rejected plans to let Musk's SpaceX launch more rockets from Vandenberg Air Force Base outside Santa Barbara, citing his habit of spewing and tweeting political falsehoods and attacking FEMA. Musk's businesses have previously lost major advertisers and large corporate customers over his political positions. And by some accounts, Musk is falling short in politics, too. While $75 million is a lot of money, the tech billionaire, according to the New York Times, was expected to contribute more than $100 million to America PAC. Republican operatives have reportedly criticized America PAC and Musk's wider voter mobilization efforts. At least two close Trump allies told the former president that the group was falling down on the job, according to Rolling Stone, which also reported on Wednesday that America PAC was still setting up its field operations. Trump, for his part, seemed satisfied with Musk's contribution. The former president has apparently promised Musk a role in his administration as the head of a new government efficiency commission, a position that Musk invented. Here's a 2024 editorial piece. It's not by Bess Levin, though. This is by Mark McKinnon. This race is Kamala Harris's to lose. Here's why. This is on October 17th. In these waning stages of the late Trump era, everything and nothing is a surprise. We've become immune. I mean, when you have the nominee of a major political party mentally unplugging during a town hall, stopping answering questions, and swaying along to his own Spotify playlist for 39 interminable minutes, and no one seems to blink, we're out of surprises. There's no big last debate, no tentpole events likely to shake up the race in these last dwindling days. Yes, a full-on war could break out in the Middle East, or another hurricane could blow ashore, wreaking havoc and Category 5 conspiracy theories. But the reality is that if nothing or everything happens between now and November 5th, it's unlikely to change the outcome. This sucker is baked. And what does that mean? Well, first of all, there aren't really any undecided voters. If you haven't figured this one out by now, chances are you're sitting it out. In effect, the oldest cliche is the oldest cliche for a reason. It all comes down to turnout. Turnout with a capital T. In other words, this election will be decided in favor of the candidate whose troops can get the most folks in the key counties in the seven swing states to actually go to the polls. I am going to make a bold prediction here because I don't just give a shit if I'm wrong. Even if this lives on the internet forever, Kamala Harris is going to win, maybe easily. Hear me out for a minute. I'm not saying this because some polls we saw are flawed. All polling is flawed these days. I mean, how many of you have answered a political poll in the last 5 or 10 years, right? So to whom are they talking? What's more, everyone in the political establishment realizes that many of the polls come from dubiously partisan polling firms, quote-unquote expert hired guns who put their thumbs on the scales by simply publishing a flurry of inaccurate but nonetheless credible tallies designed to create the perception of an advantage and in some way trigger a bandwagon effect, believing their theoretical say-so helps sway the actual electorate. Good luck with that. Even if you give professional pollsters the benefit of the doubt that they are going above and beyond and paying the extra dime to find voters and balancing or weighting their work appropriately, they are still modeling their numbers based on past races. So the most presidential election model was 2020. And people might have voted for Donald Trump or Joe Biden with conviction, but there weren't a ton of people excited about it. Here's why I say it's Harris's to lose. Trump voters may be committed, but Harris voters are excited and enthusiastic. In August, the Harris-Tim Walz ticket enjoyed an 8-point lead when it came to voter enthusiasm. And there's a big difference in the ground game. Democrats are largely paying their field workers, while Republicans are mostly relying on volunteers. There are factors not being picked up on the radar of the head-to-head polling. I'm going to pause here for a minute and remind you that you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is the Vanity Fair Hour. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We entered the politics section a bit earlier this week, and we are in the middle of an editorial about why Kamala Harris is going to win the presidential election. Let's continue. In addition, Trump suddenly seems not just lazy, weak by dodging another debate, for instance, and old, but also truly out of it. Some days he makes it seem like the 25 in Project 2025 is a secret plan to execute the 25th Amendment if he actually gets elected, paving the way for, Lord help us, President J.D. Vance. Meanwhile, Harris looks strong and confident. She is demanding another debate. She's marching into the lion's den of Fox News and perhaps Joe Rogan's podcast. She's running clips of dictatorial Donald at her rallies to cheer and jeers. On the campaign trail, she's enlisting the help of a raft of ready-for-primetime players, including Barack Obama, other top Democrats, and a number of anti-Trump Republicans. Finally, there is the gender gap. Yes, Trump has an advantage with men, but I believe that in the end, the Harris gender gap with women will shatter all previous records and be determinative. I just feel in my bones, from talks with voters of all stripes, Gen Z to the senior set, that enough women have sufficient outrage from the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision and PTSD from 2016 that they're going to crawl over broken glass to break the glass ceiling. So yes, it's going to come down to turnout, of course. And while conventional wisdom may dictate that women are more enthusiastic about voting, check out any of Turning Point Chief Charlie Kirk's campus rally videos and take a look at the sea of young men in red hats. Believe me, it'll get your attention and have you second-guessing all of the political wizards. Kirk, to be fair, has the right message when he says, "I don't care about polls. I don't care about betting markets. I don't care about vibes. I care about how many ballots are in the box. If we turn out, we win. Do the work." But when it comes out in the wash, I think women are going to do the work and save our ass and our democracy. They've been doing it for centuries, so it shouldn't be a surprise. As the Eurythmics and Aretha Franklin like to say, sisters are doing it for themselves. Here's another editorial about Trump. "We all have a lot to lose if Trump wins." This is by Molly Jong Fast, published on October 15th. "People often say to me that I wouldn't personally be infected by a second Donald Trump presidency. After all, I live in a blue city in a blue state, and I'm a married heterosexual woman who isn't looking to have any more children. I won't need medication like mifepristone for a miscarriage, although I do have girls in my family who I assume will someday want to have children, and I don't personally rely on the federal government for education because my kids don't go to public high school. So again, how would any of this affect me? The most likely answer is that as a public-facing person, I will continue to be subjected to threats, as many in the mainstream media already are. But attacks on the media could escalate if Trump returns to power, given that he doesn't hesitate to demonize journalists and call them out before his millions of followers. And given what Trump says on television, he may target American citizens for unfavorable speech. I think the bigger problem is the enemy from within," he told Maria Bartiromo on Fox News on Sunday. "Sick people, radical left lunatics, and it should be very easily handled by, if necessary, by the National Guard, or if really necessary, by the military." The quote-unquote lunatics in question could be anyone from protesters to opinion columnists, or even mainstream reporters he doesn't agree with. Trump has referred to CBS as a fake news scam whose operations are totally illegal and has similarly suggested that ABC should lose its broadcast license. What would it mean to have a president who, in this fashion, targets what little is left of the free press? It's hard to fathom, but there's a world where Trump imitates his strongman friends like Vladimir Putin or Viktor Orban or Kim Jong-un, all of whom participate in jailing or killing journalists in countries with state-regulated media. He's already taking a page from Joe McCarthy this election cycle in targeting the enemies within, something my family is all too familiar with. Few aspects of Trump's second-term plans are most openly authoritarian than his immigration platform. On Friday, Trump traveled to Aurora, a suburb of Denver, Colorado, where he's shopping Operation Aurora, a policy he said would target every illegal migrant criminal network operating on American soil by use of the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. According to the Brennan Center, the law is, quote, "a wartime authority that allows the president to detain or deport the natives and citizens of an enemy nation. The law permits the president to target these immigrants without a hearing and based only on their country of birth or citizenship. The last time the United States used the Alien Enemies Act was to put Japanese and Japanese Americans into internment camps during World War II. What would internment camps actually entail in the modern day? Well, Trump has talked about deporting up to 20 million undocumented immigrants, an operation of staggering scale that he freely admits will be bloody. The Department of Homeland Security in 2018 estimated there were 11.4 million undocumented immigrants. Pew put the number at roughly 11 million in 2022. It's impossible to imagine what deporting that many people would really look like. Maybe blue state governors would be strong enough to prevent deportation camps from being built in states like California and New York. Maybe the camps would only be in red states, or maybe they'd be erected on federal land like national parks. Then there's a question of who would run those camps. Trump, for his part, has mused about using the National Guard. Who would stop any of this, you might ask? Would a Republican Congress stop it? Who would be the grown-ups in the room? At least during the first Trump administration, the courts prevented Trump from doing some of the things he wanted to do, like ending DACA. But this time, Trump would be starting out with a 6-3 conservative majority Supreme Court, featuring three justices he appointed. Last year, we saw the Trump-friendly High Court issue two rulings that will pretty much serve as a blank check to an emboldened Trump. The first ended the Chevron deference, which will curb the power of the federal agencies and expedite the death of regulatory expertise. The other decision, which is perhaps more worrying, Trump would have a blank check to do whatever he wants if he says it's in the service of the presidency, essentially granting him blanket immunity against any crimes he commits in office. As Ninth Circuit judge and Ronald Reagan appointee Stephen S. Trott wrote, it meant that Richard Nixon could have legally ordered his plumbers to burgle the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist. Trump is telling us all about his potential plans, internment camps, going after his enemies, foreign and domestic, including, presumably, journalists. Will I be one of them? Will he clamp down on the free press? Will he take away the licenses from networks he deems insufficiently supportive of his presidency? On the campaign trail, Trump has recently posed a question of his own when it comes to voting for him, asking the crowd, "What the hell do you have to lose?" Actually, a lot. While we don't know precisely what a second Trump term will look like, it'll surely be chaotic and bleak, and could mark the end of something we certainly don't want to lose, democracy as we know it. Next up, full court press, the sports election. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump battle for the bro vote. This is by Tom Clute on October 18th. Maybe it was the "Let's go Brandon" chant that broke out during one of the undercards, or the woman in line for concessions who kept yelling about how much she hated liberals. But at a certain point last November, while taking in the red-blooded spectacle of UFC 295 at Madison Square Garden, I felt like I had gone to a Donald Trump rally and a fight had broken out. And this was all before Trump himself had arrived, making his usual hero's entrance into the arena while flanked by Tucker Carlson, Kid Rock, and UFC president Dana White. The crowd of just over 19,000 erupted when Trump was shown on the Jumbotron, making it a safe bet that at least some of those fans will be back at the Garden later this month when he holds a rally there. UFC has long been a Trump-friendly ecosystem. Fans and fighters alike tend to skew MAGA, while White is one of the former president's most boisterous supporters. And Trump, never one to shun an adoring crowd, has become a fixture at the events. In the spring, 2 days after a Manhattan jury found him guilty on 34 counts of falsifying business records, he found a support group of thousands at UFC 302 in New Jersey, where fans serenaded him with "We Love Trump" chant. As Trump looks to run up large margins among the male voters in the 2024 race, he boasts a full roster of sports figures on his side that includes UFC fighters such as Colby Covington, legendary former NFL quarterback Brett Favre, golfer John Daly, and, as of most recently, Kansas City Chiefs kicker Harrison Butker. On Saturday, former Pittsburgh Steelers star Antonio Brown is expected to speak at Trump's rally in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, according to a source familiar with the event. The Republican nominee has also hit the sports media circuit, appearing on Tuesday's episode of Bussin' with the Boys, a Barstool Sports podcast hosted by NFL players Will Compton and Taylor Lewin. "We would not be here today without Dana White," Lewin said, recalled having met Trump at UFC a couple times. When you're talking about Trump, it's very on brand for him to turn up at a UFC event. Timothy Naftali, a presidential historian and senior research scholar at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs, told me, "It's not something that started when he started playing around with the idea of running for president. That's who he is, and that's also a way of speaking directly to his base. All the fights in football track with Trump's machismo-drenched political identity, which has given rise to his male-dominated coalition. Polls have consistently shown Trump maintaining a significant edge among men, while Vice President Kamala Harris holds a large lead among women voters. The gender gap has moved the final stretch of the campaign trail into the sporting arena, as Harris and running mate Tim Walz mount a late-inning rally to pick off male voters from Trump and J.D. Vance. Last month, the Democratic campaign announced Athletes for Harris, an initiative headlined by Magic Johnson, Billie Jean King, Steve Kerr, Dawn Staley, and more, with an explicit goal of connecting with young men. And while both campaigns have blanketed NFL, college football, and MLB playoff broadcasts with ads, the Democrats took their message to the games themselves on Sunday, flying banners or skywriting above NFL stadiums in four battleground states. Harris's campaign has also sought audiences on sports-centric platforms. The Democratic nominee appeared on All the Smoke, a podcast hosted by ex-NBA players Steven Jackson and Matt Barnes, while first gentleman Doug Emhoff sat for an interview with longtime sports commentator Dan Labatard that was posted online Tuesday. For Harris, the goal for winning over male voters may echo the mantra of underdogs everywhere: chip away at the lead and keep it close. In a coin flip election, that could be the difference between a win and a loss. The challenge is to connect with young men and middle-aged men so that the gap is not so egregious, said Naftali. I think she understands the realities of politics in 2024, which is that she is not likely to win among men. But in order for her to be president, she needs to do better among men. She needs to show relatability. On Sunday, Thomas Booker IV helped the Philadelphia Eagles win their third game of the season. The next day, he was out to win votes for Harris and Walz. Booker, a defensive tackle for the Eagles, is one of 10 co-chairs for Athletes for Harris, a role that has shouldered him with additional responsibilities amid the rigors of an NFL season. On Monday, a day after he recorded a half sack in the Eagles' victory over the Cleveland Browns, Booker reported to the team facility for meetings and a weightlifting session before heading to the airport for a flight to Detroit. There, Booker joined the likes of Don Cheadle for a Monday Night Football watch party, part of the Harris campaign's Black Men Huddle Up voter outreach effort. Booker, who's in his third NFL season out of Stanford, describes sports as a third space and one of the last great uniters of American life. "What I've learned is being a player and being an athlete is one of the quickest ways to connect with anybody," Booker said. "When you look at streaming and the way that we now deliver content, most things are on demand. People don't get together and watch live runs of shows anymore. People don't congregate like that. They congregate over live sporting events, whether that's football, basketball, baseball, or whatever else." More specifically, Booker pointed out that a lot of young men congregate over sports. The Democratic campaign made no secret of whom it was targeting when it launched Athletes for Harris last month. In its announcement of the initiative, the campaign noted that the athletes are among the most trusted voices for key voting blocks, especially young men, making them uniquely qualified campaigners for Vice President Harris and Governor Walz's campaign. One such campaigner is Ben Johnson, the Los Angeles Lakers great, who appeared alongside Harris at a rally in Flint, Michigan earlier this month. "Our black men, we gotta get them out to vote. That's number one," Johnson told the crowd. The Harris campaign continued the sports theme last week, deploying Walz, who has recalled his time as a high school football coach on the campaign trail, to his home state of Minnesota for some football and pheasant hunting. Walz's Midwest itinerary also included an interview with Michael Strahan, the NFL Hall of Famer turned Good Morning America co-host, and a Michigan campaign event geared toward young black men. "Sports are the perfect avenue for our campaign to meet voters where they are, in hard-to-reach places, with an authentic and genuine message that tells them how Vice President Harris and Coach Walz are fighting for them," Harris-Walz Communications Director Michael Tyler told Vanity Fair. Booker, 24, seems like an ideal messenger for the Harris campaign, which is trying to both increase support among black men and stem Trump's gains among male voters under 30. While Harris, according to a recent New York Times Siena College poll, has the support of 78% of black voters, that share, if maintained, would mark a significant drop from both President Joe Biden's estimated share of the black vote in 2020, which was 90%, and Hillary Clinton's in 2016, which was 92%. The candidate has been trying to shore up the support with black voters, making her pitch this week on The Breakfast Club and in a sit-down with The Shade Room. At the watch party in Detroit, which was held at a black-owned bar called TV Lounge, Booker said his message was about helping young people understand the implications of each campaign's proposals. I think sometimes we get in this isolated bubble of our youth where we haven't had to interact with a lot of institutions that are directly affected by policy, Booker said. We're not married most of the time. We don't have children. So a lot of the time when it comes to healthcare or potentially being able to make a choice about when you want to have a child, they seem far away from us. Trump's pitch to voters has not exactly brimmed with substance. His stump speeches are often highlighted by meandering rants about non-existent voter fraud and Hannibal Lecter. As Booker sees it, Trump's appeal with some male voters has less to do with what he says and more to do with how he says it. When you have someone out there saying things that are honestly vulgar a lot of the time, there's a specific subset of people that looked at that as being honest, Booker said. When I asked Booker what he thought Democrats could do to improve their showing among young men, he zeroed in on the tenor of the message, citing the rhetorical stylings of Barack Obama as a model for the party. It's not even that there's more candor, but it's more off the cuff, Booker said. I think that when you look at the delivery, it's not the same reserved delivery that we might be used to from Democratic Party. When you talk about packaging the message, I think more of it just needs to be organic. Therein lies the great challenge of running against Trump. Despite the cascade of lies and sinister conspiracy theories, he is perceived by many as authentic, with his presentation seem as organic, in part because he is who he's always been. There is little daylight between the Donald Trump who ran a real estate empire and starred in a reality show and the one who is now running as the Republican nominee for a third time. The Trump who once made WWE cameos and hosted championship boxing matches at his Atlantic City casino is now a candidate who mobilizes voters one UFC pay-per-view at a time. The Republican Party clearly sees Trump's ties to sports as an asset. As President Trump has said, sports are a microcosm of life. He appreciates the dedication, training, and perseverance an athlete endures while working with a team to win big, RNC spokesperson Taylor Rogers said in a statement. America loves and values sports, just like President Trump, and that is why his appearances at sporting events produces unmatched hype and resonates with everyday Americans. Naftali noted that no other president or presidential wannabe has been associated with sports as Donald Trump, with the possible exception of George W. Bush, who was once an owner of the Texas Rangers. As president, Trump attended the 2017 President's Cup golf competition, Game 5 of the 2019 World Series, and several marquee college football games. And in his bid for a return to the White House, he has continued to gravitate toward the octagon and gridiron. Last year, Trump attended the Iowa State football game months before the state's caucuses, and in September, he was on hand for the highly anticipated showdown between Georgia and Alabama. He's brought that aspect of his personality and his fans from that world into the political world, Naftali said. I suspect that a number of those people were not regular voters before their guy ran for president. We've got a little time left for Best 11. Our first headline, Trump suggests Abraham Lincoln should have let the South keep a little slavery. This is published on the 18th. Donald Trump appeared on Fox News this morning where he, during a characteristically bizarre interview, he suggested Abraham Lincoln could have avoided the Civil War by cutting a deal with the South, which, as a reminder, wanted slavery to remain legal. Asked by a 10-year-old who his favorite president was when he was little, Trump began by saying he liked Ronald Reagan. Note, Trump was 34 when Reagan first took office and 42 when he left. And then he turned to Lincoln, who he believes was a great president, but could have been better if he'd settled the Civil War. Great presidents, Trump said. Lincoln was probably a great president, although I've always said, why wasn't that settled? You know, I'm a guy that it doesn't make sense that we had a civil war. You'd almost say, like, why wasn't that settled? As an example, Ukraine would have never happened, and Russia, if I were president, Israel would have never happened. October 7th would never have happened, as you know. It's not exactly clear what Trump thinks Lincoln should have done to settle the dispute between the North and South, the latter of which seceded from the Union largely because it wanted to keep enslaving people. Does Trump think Abe should have come to the negotiating table, art of the deal style, and let the South keep some slaves? Because that's what it sounds like. As for the idea that Ukraine would have never happened if I were president, or October 7th for that matter, these are claims that he has repeatedly made with zero evidence to back them up. He did suggest on Thursday, though, that he would end the war in Ukraine by siding with Russia, bizarrely claiming that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky let that war start. In fact, Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022. Elsewhere, in Trump's sit-down with Fox, he claimed that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is very much into women's health, that Kamala Harris is a low IQ person, and that in a Harris presidency, you won't have any cows anymore. Next Levin headline, Donald Trump, not at all worried about losing the election, demands Kamala Harris be forced off the campaign. This was also on the 18th. Once upon a time, Donald Trump thought he had the 2024 election in the bag and that he was going to cruise to victory against Joe Biden. And as the polls indicated, circa July, he was probably right. And then Kamala Harris replaced the president on the Democratic ticket, and now the outcome of the election is anyone's guess. And that's clearly freaking out the Republican nominee, as evidenced by his most recent rant demanding that Harris be kicked out of the race and replaced by Biden with 18 days to go. On Truth Social, on Thursday, Trump declared Kamala should be investigated and forced off the campaign, and Joe Biden allowed to take back his rightful place. He got 14 million primary votes. She got none. This whole sordid and fraudulent event is a threat to democracy. If you're wondering what exactly he wants Harris investigated over, it appears to have something to do with her interview on 60 Minutes. But as usual with Trump, no one ever knows. This is also far from the first time he's said Harris, who he knows actually has a shot at beating him, should be removed from the race. In August, he boldly and insanely claimed the vice president should be disqualified because of a made-up story about her faking her crowd sizes using AI. That never actually happened, but it didn't stop Trump from telling his followers, "Look, we caught her with a fake crowd. There was nobody there. And everything about Kamala is fake." Trump has also claimed that the Democrats stole the campaign from Biden, and he's weirdly fantasized about the president returning to the race. And to be fair, you can see why he would want, nay, be desperate for that to happen. In related news, Politico reported on Friday that an interview Trump had been in talks to do had not materialized because he was exhausted. Naturally, Trump's national press secretary refuted that claim, calling it unequivocally false. Next headline, and my favorite, Donald Trump calls himself the father of IVF, and then says that he only learned what IVF was this year at Women's Issues Town Hall. This is on the 16th. With less than 3 weeks to go until the presidential election, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are effectively in a dead heat. Yet when it comes to support among women, the vice president is absolutely trouncing the ex-president, beating him by a whopping 15 points, according to a new poll. Even just taking white women into account, Trump is faring historically bad and is on track to put up the worst numbers of any GOP candidate in a century with that particular demographic. Hence the decision to participate in a town hall with Fox News on Tuesday night that focused on women's issues, which went, well, probably exactly how one would expect such an event to go, meaning he spent a significant amount of time ranting about immigrants and almost no time giving substantive answers to people's questions. Asked why the government is involved in women's basic rights, i.e. the right to have an abortion, Trump responded by telling his favorite lie, that everyone wanted Roe v. Wade overturned. And what will he do to make bacon more affordable? Following a detour about how the war in Ukraine on October 7th would not have happened on his watch, his big answer regarding inflation was, "We have to get prices down." On the topic of transgender athletes participating in women's sports, he declared that he's just going to ban it. Asked about what he plans to do to make childcare more affordable, Trump invoked his daughter, Ivanka. One of the few women in his life he hasn't had vile things to say about, while referring to the increase in the child tax credit during his first term, and conveniently left out the part about how it disproportionately benefited high-income families. He also said he wants to bring down corporate taxes, because of course he does, and then vaguely claimed that he's going to readjust things so that it's fair to everybody. Perhaps his weirdest answer was in regard to in vitro fertilization. First, he bizarrely and creepily told the audience, "I'm the father of IVF." And then he told a story about Alabama Senator Katie Britt, whom he described as a young and fantastically attractive, calling him up about the issue and needing to explain to him what IVF is. The call, he says, came after the Alabama Supreme Court ruled that frozen embryos are children, which happened in February of 2024, meaning the father of IVF only learned what IVF was this year. Elsewhere, over the course of the evening, the former president unsurprisingly told more than a dozen lies about everything from the Haitian immigrants living legally in Springfield, Ohio, to his infamous border wall. Are you loving him now, ladies? And our last headline, Kamala Harris just comes out and says it. Donald Trump is fucking nuts. This is October 15th. Kamala Harris used a rally in Pennsylvania on Monday to concisely lay out the reason voters must cast their ballot for her and not her opponent come November 5th. Donald Trump is a dangerous lunatic who should not be allowed within 1,000 feet of the White House ever again. After playing a clip of Trump saying the military should be used against people who don't support him on Election Day, Harris told the crowd in Erie County, Pennsylvania, "A second Trump term would be a huge risk for America. And dangerous. Donald Trump is increasingly unstable and unhinged, and he's out for unchecked power." While a recent New York Times, Philadelphia Inquirer, Siena College poll put the vice president ahead of the ex-president by 3 points in Pennsylvania, a win in the battleground state is far from assured. Speaking at the rally last night, Harris told the crowd, "Erie County, you are a pivot county. How you all vote in presidential elections often ends up predicting the national result. Erie County has voted for the winner in each of the last 4 presidential elections." Senator John Fetterman, who won the county by 9 points in 2022, told the group assembled, "You pick the president." And while he reminded everyone that in the 2020 contest, Joe Biden showed up, smoked that clown, and sent him home, Fetterman also warned that it would not be easy to beat Trump there again. Speaking to reporters before the rally, the Democratic senator said that Trump has a very unique and special connection there in rural Pennsylvania, and that's why he's going to be incredibly difficult. Noting the many rural counties packed with pro-Trump signs, Fetterman explained, "It's kind of like a Taylor Swift concert where you have so much swag, it goes beyond a typical kind of politics." Yet Fetterman also argued that it's not make or break for Harris in the rural parts of the state. "Sometimes it's not about turning these counties blue," he said. "You're not going to change the culture of rural county Pennsylvania. It's about reaching out to reachable people. I would be surprised if she wins by 3 points. She will win Pennsylvania, but I would expect it might be closer than that." Anyway, here's what Trump was up to on Monday night. According to a post on Kamala HQ on X, Trump appears lost, confused, and frozen on stage as multiple songs play for 30-plus minutes, and the crowd pours out of the venue early. This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. I thank you so much for listening. Join me next week for another full hour of stories from Vanity Fair. As we get closer to Election Day, we're going to have a lot more coverage. And of course, we'll see what Bess Levin is up to next week. So thank you for listening and have a great week, everybody.